So today we're going to discuss aesthetics and spirituality. When we mean aesthetics, we mean the aesthetic experience and spirituality. The aesthetic experience of feeling some type of beauty in form or sound or literature, etc. So, and this has a great tradition, especially within India. Actually, I found this amazing quote from the Bhagavatam. This is from Krishna to Uddhava. It's one of the forms of an aesthetic experience, and one thing that I'm going to concentrate on a little bit today is the experience of drama. And that will also lead our drama group will meet today after this. My dear Uddhava, narrations of my pastimes and qualities are all auspicious and purify the entire universe. A faithful person who constantly hears, glorifies, and remembers such transcendental activities, who through dramatic performances relives my pastimes, beginning with my appearance, and who takes full shelter of me, obtains unflinching devotional service to me, the eternal personality of God. So it's very, very much part of the tradition of bhakti, as a way to communicate bhakti. Actually, I'll just start with a story just to illustrate this, and then I'm going to get back how... Well, let's just talk about drama at the very beginning, how it communicates something. I'm going to say this. It's too good. I'm not going to do it. It's really an interesting story. First, we'll do this. Aesthetics and spirituality. If you could define spirituality in one word, what word would you give? What? Is there a word, materiality? Materialism. Spirituality, one word.
Love.
Okay. What?
Love.
What?
Love.
Love?
What? After hearing some of your recent lectures, I might say harmony.
Harmony? Okay.
Beauty.
What?
Beauty.
Love.
Faith.
Love.
Pure.
Faith.
Purity.
Pure.
Light.
What?
Light.
Vices? What?
Light.
Light. Light is spirituality.
Service.
Okay. Anybody else?
Rasa.
What? Rasa? Fortunately, I'm deaf. What did he say?
Gulabdumans.
What?
Gulabdumans.
Gulabdumans is spirituality. Okay. Let's use the word selflessness. Okay? Selflessness is spirituality. And it encompasses all those other things. What's the opposite of spirituality? Can you give a word?
Selfishness.
Selfishness? That's good. That's pretty good. That's actually brilliant. Yeah, selfishness. How about we'll use the word ego, but not in the just identity, but that sense of, and I like to put it, the consciousness of centering yourself in the world and kind of seeing the world for you. And from that concept, we try to get power to control the world for us. So spirituality means to kind of get out of that concept, that desire to enjoy and control, rather than the desire, let's say, to serve. It's also, spirituality is also an identity. An identity can be maybe I am the servant. An ego is I am the master. I am the controller. And spiritual life means somehow or other how to move out of that concept. And there are different yogas specifically to do that. Yoga, one definition I found of yoga would be transcending the false self. How to get over that false self. I was reflecting the other day, one of my core anxieties in life, everybody has different samskaras. Some things are not, you know, some things people are not bothered by at all, and something. I have an anxiety that when I do a function, everything is not, you know, I want it to be so perfect. And it's like, and even if I know it's going to be organized, I was driving to this function on Saturday, and I knew it was completely organized. And I'm saying, why am I in anxiety? You know, it's just the way the mind works. Right? Why am I anxiety about this? Other things, I mean, one person once said to me, Maharaj, you could be falling out of the Empire State Building on the 50th floor, say, so far, so good. I didn't get a laugh at that. That was brilliant. Anyway. So, and I was just reflecting. I was just reflecting, and then everything went perfectly. And then I was watching how the things that were insignificant before, then they replaced the anxiety. Now you have the next one. And then I was reflecting, what is the cause of all this? You know, it's that ego. It's that ego that has a particular way of seeing things for oneself rather than seeing things for God and others. And then the desire to control it. And it just... So spiritual life means there are different processes where you somehow have to transcend the false self. Somehow. Jnana by knowledge. Bhakti by love. In fact, that's exactly what the whole Vedas is about. The whole show of the material world is about the theme of everything that goes. It's somehow or other to move us out. What is the definition of liberation in the bhakti tradition? Anybody know this one?
Sure.
There's 10 subject matters in the Srimad Bhagavatam. The 9th subject is mukti. You know how mukti is defined? Liberation, it says... Muktir hitva yata rupam. What does hitva mean? Give up. What? Yata rupam. The other form, the external identity. I am the controller. I am the enjoyer. Everything. Me, 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 me. Give up all that concept. And sarupena vivastita. And be situated in your sarup. Your real identity. What is your real identity? Your real servant. Your real identity is somehow or other we're a particle of consciousness, of the supreme consciousness, which reaches its perfection in love. If you think, when I become perfect, I will be, can it be anything else than filled with love and devotion and selflessness and service? So real culture, real spirituality, any process, that is the aim, how to do that. So what this class will be about is about how the history, a little bit, of the aesthetic experience is meant to do that. Touching a little bit upon how it's specifically prominent in the path of bhakti. and then to demonstrate that principle by a short original drama that was written to demonstrate this principle. How to get you out of the center by the aesthetic experience. Now, in India, there's a shastra about that, a sacred text about that, called the Natya Shastra. In fact, I'd have to say also, just before I get into that, especially in bhakti, if you want to communicate bhakti or devotion or sentiment, it's not best done generally by prose. It's generally done by poetry. Because what poetry does, it just doesn't explain something, it becomes something that actually communicates to you. And in our line, our great teachers were also great poets. They were called kavis. And they're not only great poets, but they had this standard of poetry called kavi. It's a poet that whose word craft is inconceivable. Their ability with words. And they would use the Sanskrit language because it was so rich in grammar to give you the facility to create meanings. And in fact, one of our greatest teachers, he wrote this book called, and it's going to come out by the Bhaktivedanta Book Trust actually, called Chitra Rupini, where there's 12 exercises to test your ability of wordcraft. And it blew my mind. When you see what the person is, you have to write a poem almost like in a New York Times crossword puzzle, but without the little black spots, just backwards, and then the poem has to say the same thing frontwards and backwards. And then it, when it blows your mind, you understand it says the same thing diagonally and around. And then there's another one where you have to write a poem with one syllable about Krishna's pastimes. You want to hear the poem? Ninu nanu ninu na ninu ninu. It's just the same syllable. But they combine it together with meaning. And the poems would express such deep sentiments. Then when Lord Chaitanya heard, when Sarup Damodar, which was Lord Chaitanya's aesthetic supreme disciple, when he heard the poems of Rupa Goswami and how they affected the heart, when they chanted one verse about the holy name, Haridas Thakur is a Namachari, when he heard this verse encapsulated about the holy name, Haridas Thakur began to dance in ecstasy, the glories of the holy name. And when Sarup Damodar heard it, he said, "This is wonderful." He said, "What is the use of a bowman's arrow and a poet's words if they don't pierce the heart and make the head spin?" So there's a whole tradition of communicating the consciousness that we are aspiring for through literature. And that's what Lord Chaitanya, in the end of Lord Chaitanya's life, he showed us how to, what's the goal of spirituality and bhakti? You should have love. And what kind of love? Love means relationship. A relationship with God in a particular friendship and a particular romance, a particular mood of parental affection. You should have that kind of experience and that love. And it would be communicated so incredibly in all these different poems. And Lord Chaitanya, therefore, at the end of his life, when he was trying to cultivate the highest consciousness, which is he wanted love. Lord Chaitanya wanted love. But what kind of love? He wanted the love of the topmost devotee. When? At the height of her love. That's what bhakti means. It means to be... And what is the highest love in Sanskrit is called rasa. Rasa means aesthetic experience. What's an aesthetic experience? When you become, in drama, it's when you become overwhelmed with a particular emotion. Right? If you really have an aesthetic experience, you will cry when you see a tragedy. You will laugh when you see a comedy. You will be terrified when you see the blob. I just wanted to see how many people are over 50. You know, Alfred Hitchcock, The Birds, wow. That's a scary one. And romance, and chivalry, and different emotions that are communicated. It's so powerful. So in the bhakti tradition, specifically poetry and drama would be used at an advanced stage of spiritual life to inculcate in your heart the moods of devotion that you were aspiring for. And Lord Chaitanya would sit in the end of his life when he was in Puri and he'd be chanting the holy name, but he would chant the holy name, which was Krishna, in a mood of sambandha or relationship. And he would enrich that relationship by hearing songs by Srup Damodar, and he would hear dramas by Ramananda Roy, and then people would try to bring different dramas, and this is how that mood would be created. So there's this Natya Shastra, it's about 2,000 years old, and the story behind it was that King Indra went to Lord Brahma and said, "We're giving so much philosophy, so many teachings, we have a whole social structure in place," because Indra was the king of heaven, and Brahma was the creator of the universe, this particular universe, and they were concerned. And what was their concern? Their concern was people were not overcoming ego. So Lord Brahma thought very, very carefully, and he said, "Ah, we need something audible and visible to help people overcome ego." And then this Natya Shastra was channeled, because this great Bharat Muni, he was meditating and it was channeled. And it became this drama theory. And basically the way it would work was very interesting. Basically Bharat Muni, he was studying this overwhelming human experience. And there were eight in number: tragedy, humor. When you have tragedy, there's nothing you can think about. You're completely consumed. When there's chivalry, charge. And if you have the qualification of being patriotic, you will be overwhelmed with the feeling of Karuna Ras or Vira Ras. So there was these different experiences. So he studied them, and it came from Bharat Muni. It was analyzed. Who are the people who have this experience? This Rasa theory, I've studied it. I've written on it. Who are the people that have this experience? Then, what is the core feeling of this experience? What are the actions of this experience? What are the emotions of this experience? And what are the ecstatic symptoms of this experience? They're actually five. It's a very technical thing. There's actually five bhavas, five emotional experience. I can't go into the theory now, but they have to fit. Different relationships have different experiences. For example, actions in love. Let's say you see a great teacher, Prabhupada, walks in. Then the action of love, called the anubhav, is you'll pay your obeisances. And that won't just be a physical action, it'll be an emotion. But if you see someone who's your junior You may give them blessings and pat them on the head. Imagine if Prabhupada came in and you went, good boy. It's so distasteful. So they would describe, it was a theory. And what would happen is, it's a very detailed theory. It's so beautifully complex. And when it was in place, what would happen is, then when you would write a drama, and in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, which is one of the books that Prabhupada wrote, it has detailed discussions of this. The proper introduction and drama. In fact, Rupa Goswami, in our line, it's a little technical. When you take the Bhakti 101 course, you'll learn about Rupa Goswami, and you'll learn why in our tradition, even though there are many great saints, we are called Rupanuga. We are the followers of this particular saint called Rupanuga, called Rupa Goswami particularly. We're called Rupanugas. And somehow, the beginning of Alzheimer's. Yeah. Remember the point I was making before that? Someone can help me?
A little technical.
What?
No, the complexity of the message
transfer.
What?
Rupanugas.
The five babas.
What?
The five babas.
Five babas. I forgot where I was going. It was a good place, too. What?
Rupa's use of the Natha Shastras in presenting Bhagavatam or something like that.
We're called Rupanugas. Okay, I'll just go on anyway, but it'll come back to me. So what happens is... Oh, yeah. I got it now. He wrote dramas. And in some of the dramas, he was the director. And the director would come on the stage in the drama. You know, and they would set the scene. You know, it would be Govardhan Hill, the beautiful night. I see all the assembled Vaishnavas are assembled here in this auspicious day on 2nd Avenue, 1st Avenue, in the beautiful month of whatever, the beginning of September. And the assembly, he would say it was such a beautiful thing. But he would say that, it would be Govardhan. So here's how basically it would work. They had such an understanding of how to create what's called rasa, this experience. So it's a real experience in life. They'd study it, how to create it in drama so that the audience would experience the same thing. And then there was a whole history of how different spiritual groups would analyze this as either a spiritual experience in itself or leading to a spiritual experience. In other words, the audience would have a feeling. In other words, it would be recreated. And it was very, very technical. And if it wasn't composed properly, the feeling wouldn't mature. And a cultured person wouldn't be affected. They describe it, it's just like feeding sweet rice to a connoisseur. Right? A connoisseur means someone who has fine tastes. So to satisfy them, the milk has to be cooked properly. It can't be too thick. Right? You have this feast and the cook is just a new person and you get like paste and rice. Or they're a new person and you get rice floating in milk. But it has to be cooked right, and the rice is not too mushy, it's not too hard, and then the amount of sugar, if it's too sweet or not sweet enough, and the right amount of spices. So they describe, when you feed a connoisseur, they will appreciate it. So it's the same thing in the theory of drama. There were all these ingredients, and they would have to be just right, and if they were right, the qualified audience would have that experience. But what they would say is, this is how they determine a spiritual. For one thing, there would be a sense, spiritual means to get rid of the limited sense of I, of me in the center. So anyone knows, if you do a good performance, or you're a good speaker, or whatever it is, you create one mind in the audience. If you're teaching, and you feel people are understanding different things, And it's really, it's like a kirtan. If everyone's experiencing, it's a spiritual experience. It gets you out of the limited sense of I. So they would have some analysis like that. I'll just read just a few things because we don't have a lot of time. But this is, it said this. For the duration of the aesthetic experience, one steps out of ordinary time and space, and most importantly, identity. In the Greeks, I think they call this catharsis. It's if someone said this, same obstacles that prevent one from enjoying a poem or drama are the same obstacles that maintain the elusive I. So they had all these theories. The spectator no longer felt in connection with the empirical I of the spectator. It is the power of abolishing the limited personality. So it was kind of some kind of unity that people would... They'd have this idea. You'd step out of the limited I. And what would happen is, because what happened is you'd have this powerful experience. Like you'd actually feel tragedy, or you'd actually feel some romantic feelings, or you'd actually feel some chivalry. But you'd have an experience, but it wasn't connected to your ego. They would experience, but it wouldn't be your ego. So somehow or other, the Bharat Muni and what Lord Brahma and Indra, they felt that this was a type of way to at least direct people to spirituality and elevate people from ego, etc., by an aesthetic experience. And then, and now I'll tell the story how this works. You see, my grandmother in those days, it was a different type of culture, so my grandmother was 15. She got married to my grandfather. And the famous story was their first date was my grandfather was showing her the piece of property he was buying. Anyway, it's a famous story. They met over the lots. It's called a lot. They were looking at a lot on Bedford Avenue. Whatever the case is, they quickly had three children. My mother was the oldest, and then 2 years of my uncle, and then my grandfather. No more romance, separate beds. And my grandmother suffered for the rest of her life. Because she was so dynamic. My grandmother, very beautiful. But there was no divorce. So they suffered. And then, on their 50th wedding anniversary, my mother and father took them to a Broadway play. And you know what Broadway play they took him to? Fiddler on the Roof. Should I break into the matchmaker? So it was, and it was, what was the drama about? It was about Russia, where my grandparents were born, and the romance and the matchmaking of that. I never saw the drama, etc. I know something about it. So my grandfather was sitting here, my grandmother was sitting here, my mother was sitting here, and my father was sitting here. So during that drama about the romance of Russia at the time when they broke out with matchmaker, matchmaker, make me, my grandfather grabbed my grandmother's hand affectionately. They were holding hands. And my grandmother turned to her daughter and my mother and went, but what happened? Emotion was communicated very, very powerfully. So now, I'm just going to say briefly what happened in our tradition, and then we'll do a drama. So later than that, 1,500 years later than that, this Rupa Goswami, he studies the Bhagavatam. Now, the Bhagavatam, according to our tradition, predates the Natyashastra. But then he sees an amazing thing, that the pastimes and stories of Krishna are perfectly composed. And this is not an easy thing. When they bring dramas to Lord Chaitanya, they wouldn't even bring it to him, because if the drama wasn't perfectly composed, the bhava, the affection, whether it was tragedy or love, would not reach rasa. It would be called rasabhas. It was a reflection of it. It wouldn't reach its maturity. And it wouldn't have the effect. So Rupa Goswami was amazed. This book, the stories of Krishna, the Bhagavad Purana, is perfectly composed according to classical, the Natyashastra. It's very, to do that. And then he had a realization, well, if this predated the Natyashastra, then he understood something. What the Bhagavatam is duplicating and expressing is not taking a mundane emotion and having the audience feel it, creating a catharsis or a unity where they have an experience beyond the limited eye, but it was actually a description of the ultimate consciousness of reality, which is called bhakti ras, love of Godhead. And therefore it can predate the Natyashastra, because the Natyashastra is actually a reflection of the ultimate reality, that Krishna's pastimes are the perfect expression of love. And then what Rupa Goswami began to do, he just began to write poem after poem. He began to write drama after drama on Krishna's pastimes. And the process of bhakti is chanting Hare Krishna and listening to drama. The Bhagavatam is perfectly composed. The poems of Rupa Goswami are perfectly composed, that communicate bhakti to you, the ultimate consciousness. If you go in Vrindavan in the month of July, there'll be no less than 100 drama groups of Krishna's pastimes. And the saintly people, they'd be sitting there. They'll be sitting, you know, very simple people. This means their beads, and they're holding their beads, and they'd sit in these dramas. And they would be affected. The devotion would be communicated. So this is a very important part of bhakti, and it's the Bhagavatam and in the poem and in the dramas. So, in that regard, what I'm going to do now is I'm going to do a drama, a 25-minute drama, which will communicate the feeling of bhava or love that's expressed in Krishna's pastimes. It was done by a young man from our bhakti club at NYU. Now he's in his 30s. He was in the New York NYU School of Dramatic Arts. He's brilliant. And he came to Govardhan Hill in Vrindavan. And he spent 3 weeks with me, where I took one of the stories of Krishna and guided him. But he has the word craft. And he wrote this drama. I've done it many times. People have seen it, but we'll do it again, and I think it could have that effect of creating maybe some feeling. And Megan will do it for me. I think you could sit there, and when the cue comes, then you can come up here. We'll move this out here. Okay? And it's only about a 20-minute drama. You've done this many times.
Should I bring this mic up?
Yeah, bring the mic up. And in the drama, actually, we used to have a building on 55th Street. It was one of the mistakes the Krishna consciousness movement made that the bhakti center is trying to rectify. And it had a theater. And Prabhupada used to sit in the theater and watch the dramas that the devotees did. So I play a sadhu, an old man from Vrindavan. Maybe we'll play a coward. There's two parts of the drama. When I was younger, and the world was younger, and our spirits were younger, I lived in the mystical land of Vrindavan, which I suppose too is younger, though really it was an ageless place. This was a city of magnificent temples, sadhus and sages, saintly widows, rich and colorful history. Monkeys. At the time, no cell phones or computers. But most importantly, it was the home of Krishna, his friends, his family, and his well-wishers. I was charged with saving the ancient Vaishnav libraries filled with musty old books, all but forgotten tombs that contain deep and esoteric passages of spiritual history and wisdom. In such a library belonging previously to the late Pran Krishna Baba, it seemed that all the books were far too damaged by time or lack of proper care to be salvageable. I was prepared to abandon the collection, but then I saw one book lying on the floor apart from the rest. I immediately picked it up, knowing that regardless of its title or current condition, no such sacred book should lie on the floor. To my amazement, it was in near perfect condition. I turned the front page. I turned the cover and glanced at the front page. Hari Lila Prakash, 17th century, Sri Damodar Bahulinath. I had never heard of the author, but as I read on, I found his claims and insights remarkable. He claimed to be a 17th century descendant of one of Krishna's most intimate associates, the son. His great, 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 great grandson, and so on. Hari Lila Prakash is a first person account by the son of his exploits with Krishna in the beautiful surroundings of the Vrindavan forest. My friends, my hands were shaking. The hairs on my neck were standing on end. I realized I was holding a precious jewel. It was as if the book wanted me to find it. Among the most fascinating aspects of Hari Lila Prakash is found in the appendix entitled Sri Krishna Lila, A Reasonable Conception of Divinity. It seems that Damodar writes that his lifelong concern is that people would think that the pastimes of Krishna were mythological or mere fables or mundane, and thus the deep spiritual import would be lost. Listen to his ideas. I think you'll appreciate their significance. I have some transcript of it. Sri Damodar Bahulinath states, all of us are seeking pleasure, and our greatest pleasure is found in pure, unmotivated love. If pure love is our guiding and universal principle, then why should it not be part of its source, the ultimate reality? As pure love entails a mutual exchange, then the one harmonious truth must have a type of discrimination within. There must be personality, beauty, and other qualities to enhance the flow of love. 4. This flow of love is known as Shakti or energy, and like all energy, devoted to bringing pleasure to its source. 5. Thus the Vaishnav conception of reality is divine lila, a drama that staged the perfect expression of love, an exchange of devotion between the source of all energies, Sri Krishna, and the supreme Shakti, Sri Radha. My friends, I felt like crying. Such a deep concept, but explained in such simple and understandable terms. I now understood why the great Vaishnav teachers write about rasa, the height of divine love. As that which one appreciates gradually belongs to us, by hearing these divine stories, the same devotional feelings come within our heart. Sri Damodar continues, and just as love and pleasure to be appreciated to its fullest requires a variety of loving exchanges, why should not friendship, parental affection, and the love of secret and intimate dalliance not exist in its pure sense in the pure realm? For those of you who don't know, Krishna is a young cowherd boy that takes care of his father's cows. This job afforded him the opportunity to befriend other boys occupied with the same task. They would gallivant all over Vrindavan, playing in the fields, resting in the shade of trees, and sharing wonderful meals, all the while increasing their mutual admiration and affection. But in Vrindavan, like every place else, there are those that are opposed to even a trace of the flow of divine love. Demons! But if you think about it, don't the challenges to love only increase our affection? Did you ever fear the loss of a loved one? Was it not at that time that love reached its heights? That's why I'm so excited to tell this to you. Because Hari Lila Prakash tells the stories of such divine love. Maybe I have time for just one short story. One day, the water of the Jamuna was visited by a multi-headed serpent named Kaliya. He was poisoning the water with the stench and fumes emanating off his hideous body, causing any creature to drink or even visit to immediately die. But wonderful, oh wonderful Krishna would not stand for such a travesty, because the demon was threatening the livelihood and wonder of his friends, his family, and his loved ones, causing them unimaginable anxiety. Imagine how they felt. No, don't imagine. Just hear. It wouldn't be proper for me to keep the insights of Damodar Bahulanath to myself. Hear an account by a witness to those pastimes, those days. And listen to these loving exchanges. Listen carefully, for one who hears these pastimes with attention, the same causeless love will manifest in the heart. So now I'm going to read from the text. Damodar Bahulanath writes, upon returning home late one day from the forest, after Krishna's horrifying and then glorious struggle with the Kaliya serpent, I, the son, approach my worried mother with her arms crossed and a stick in her hand.
Mother! Mother! I've just seen the most amazing...
Yes, I know I'm late. I know I made you worry. Okay, you're right, it's my fault, but there's something... No, I didn't do it on purpose. Mother! Mother, no! It's about Krishna! Yes, Krishna. My friend Krishna was in trouble, and so were the rest of us. My friends, that is. But then Krishna wasn't in trouble. And then, well, neither were we. You'll listen without punishing me, Mother? I've seen the most wonderful thing. We were out in the fields taking care of the cows. While we walked, we were talking about how glad we were that Krishna and Balaram had dealt with the nasty demons in the Talwan forest. And the delicious fruits were now ripe to be picked, and the poor innocent animals need no longer be afraid. What's that, Mother? Why am I late? Right. Well, with the warm sun shining so brightly, and after walking so far and working so hard, we became very thirsty. Krishna told us to follow him to the Yamuna, so we fell in step behind him and watched his feet leave perfect imprints in the dust and grass. When we got to the water, our throats were so parched that we drank and drank. And well, what we hadn't noticed was, well, the water, it was, well, poisoned. I know, Mother, I know. It sounds terrible, but I'm alive now. Not that I was dead before. At least I don't think so. I know, it sounds confusing, but all I know is when I drank the water, I felt very funny. The next thing I know, the other boys were clutching at their throats and falling to the ground. My head began to ache. My body felt very weak. I was gasping for air. I felt my life slipping away moment by moment. And just as my eyes closed for what I thought was the last time, I felt a warmth flowing through my body, filling my heart with love. I opened my eyes and Mother, I was staring directly into Krishna's smiling face. The pain was nowhere to be found. All fear and worry had left me. I looked around at the other boys. They were no longer writhing on the ground. They looked as happy and surprised as me. We knew that somehow Krishna had saved us from the poison water. But better than not being dead, Mother, was waking to Krishna's friendly face greeting me. If only every moment of awakening were filled with such a happy sight. Always our protector, always our best friend. No, Mother, that's not the end of the story. It gets better. Do you want me to continue? You very much want to hear the rest? I'm so glad. Does that mean I'm not in trouble? No, I didn't think so. Next part is scary, Mother. We looked in the water to see if we could find what had made it so deadly. The most horrifying image. A giant, many-headed snake swirled in the Yamuna, its skin as black as night, its eyes red as flame, and from its gaping nostril cloud of poisonous nightmares. I was petrified. I was rooted to the spot. The air around the Yamuna became so foul. The lush grass was turning brown and brittle, and the very life was being sucked out of the trees. I saw a bird flying overhead towards the bank of the Yamuna. I called out a warning, "Turn back!" But it was too late. As soon as it flew into the poisonous clouds, it fell down, dead. Tears welled up in my eyes. This beast was destroying Vrindavan, our beautiful home. I looked at my friends, and their faces said they felt the same as me. Except for Krishna. He looked angrier than I have ever seen him, and so determined. I didn't know what he intended to do, but already his bravery was lessening my fear. I could see on his face what he was thinking. Serpent, how dare you poison the waters of the Yamuna? How dare you harm the beauty of this spot where I so often have rested with my friends on these soft grasses that you have turned to ash? Enjoyed the sweet fragrances that you have laid to waste. How dare you harm the animals and people of Vrindavan? Krishna strode forward and climbed one of the dead kadamba trees. He tightened the cloth of his belt as if he was about to do something that required his full effort. And then he waved his arms like this. My friend Krishna looked so brave and powerful. I felt like cheering, Mother. And then Krishna jumped into the water. But I see other people have come to listen to my story. My words have attracted the saintly souls of Vrindavan. But these people, men and women, young and younger, they are all there at the Yamuna. They can say whether my story is true, Mother. Which reminds me, why are you not at the Yamuna? A calf was injured? By a flaming rock falling from the sky? Mother, I know you overcome with grief and worry, but taking care of the cows is one of our most important duties. I know why the rock fell, Mother. Yes, because it seemed Krishna was in great danger. When Krishna jumped into the water, he created a splash so large, it was like a mighty tidal wave. As we ducked away from the poisonous boiling water, for a moment we couldn't see the Yamuna or anything in front of us as the water cascaded down onto the surrounding land. When we could see again, the Kadamba tree that Krishna had jumped from, that was dead before, was now very much alive and blossoming with yellow flowers. Krishna swam in the water towards the serpent, slapping the water with his arms and calling out with such a mighty roar, I would have covered my ears from the deafening sound had it not so reminded me of the most beautiful music coming from Krishna, so much like the songs he would sing while strolling through the forest accompanied by a symphony of birds. The serpent became so enraged. But how could you be angry at Krishna? With such wondrous melodies filling the air, when his playing in the water made him glisten like a cloud in his yellow silken garments, with his sportive smile a true reflection of his pure heart. But none of this mattered to the serpent, and he struck at Krishna like lightning, biting him in the chest and wrapping him in his coils. I immediately called out in grief. I fell on my knees. The cows began to wail, and then the earth shook, and pieces of flaming rock fell from the sky. Could Krishna be dead? Oh, Krishna! Soon all the residents of Vrindavan gathered at the Yamuna, each demanding to know what had become of Krishna, but I was so shocked I couldn't speak. Mother Yasoda tried to rush into the festering, boiling water, but the other women caught her, and in desperation she fainted in their arms. The only words that could comfort her were the triumphs of Krishna. I have never seen a more piteous sight, Mother. My heart breaks to think of her pain as she watched Krishna's limp body being crushed in the serpent's coils. Nanda Maharaj and the other men, they also rushed to the water, but Balaram stopped them in their tracks. All around, the residents of Vrindavan were in fits of lamentation. I wish there was something I could do to save Krishna, but I was left hopeless. But then, as Balaram pushed the man back from the water, I noticed his face. And how strange, Mother. While the rest of us wept and called out to Krishna, he was smiling, as if he knew all would be well. The gopis' faces said they now saw the world was vacant without Krishna. Looks of despair so heavy, I never wished to see such pain again. And Balaram smiled. I'm not joking when I say I felt like my life was ending, Mother. For without my friend Krishna, I wouldn't want to be alive. Balaram smiled. And soon I saw why. When all of the animals and people of Vrindavan were present, Krishna freed himself from the serpent's coils. The serpent tried to bite him with his fangs as sharp as daggers, his flaring nostrils like cauldrons of boiling hatred, but Krishna circled around, so agile, so swift. I could see the serpent beginning to tire, and oh, wonder of wonders, in a single bound, Krishna jumped to the top of the serpent's hoods. I gasped in admiration. The breath caught in my throat. Krishna, the true artist that he is, began to dance on the serpent's head. The rays of the sun shone through the jewels on the serpent's head, making Krishna's feet appear glowing red as he ducked and span, leapt and twirled, his lotus feet moving so quickly no one could hope to dance in such a way. As soon as each hood would move to strike Krishna, he would simply knock it down with his dancing feet. I was awestruck, but it felt like watching a disturbed mind saying it still had power when Krishna's lotus feet had destroyed any chance of its survival. From the shore, we could see the serpent was becoming exhausted, for from its mouths came pools of blood,
and poison, and even fire. But still the dance went on. What a display of art and bravery. Krishna's dancing feet knocked down each foot so fast, it appeared the serpent was bowing down before Krishna. And the garlands of the blood flowing from his mouth, like garlands being offered at Krishna's feet. The serpent's wives came forward, their clothes and jewels all a mess as they rushed in their distress, praying to Krishna to please have mercy on their demon husband. Their prayers were so sad and heartfelt, Mother. I couldn't help but take pity on them. They begged that their husband must have had many, many lifetimes of piety if he now had Krishna's lotus feet upon his head. And I thought that the most beautiful prayer. Krishna stopped his dance, and he ordered the serpent to leave at once and never return, never again poison the Yamuna or harm the animals or residents of Vrindavan. There were cheers from the onlookers. I cried tears of joy at the relief. Krishna had saved our home, but Krishna was also safe from harm. What would any of us do if we lost Krishna? So, you see, Mother, it was out of concern for my very best friend that I was unable to come home. I have never seen a more amazing sight than Krishna's serpent dance. I hope you will forgive me, Mother, and that we will tell this story over and over again, forevermore.
That in such a short time with everything else she did, she learned all those lines. And I was prompting, but she didn't miss anything. That was pretty good. So the idea would be is that this actually not just tells you what bhakti is, but it makes you feel it. And that's the purpose of rasa, the aesthetic experience in drama, in poetry, in art, etc. Just a side note, with this kind of template, I'm having someone now compose other pastimes. And they've actually made a visual background with music that accompanies it. So maybe one time it can be performed also in a theater. And now we're having a drama group here to do that also. And they'll actually meet today. So, Srila Prabhupada, please.